From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. The president is on his way home from D-Day commemorations in Europe and is turning his focus to tariffs. According to White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders, he still plans to order a 5% tariff on all goods coming to the U.S. from Mexico. The president's threatening tariffs to try to get Mexico to stanch the influx of Central Americans trying to enter the country. Mexico says it will deploy 6,000 troops to its border with Guatemala to try to stop migrants coming from there. NPR's chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley joins us now. Hi, Scott.
Good to be with you.
So Mexico has made some concessions, but the administration is not apparently satisfied by those concessions. Here's Mark Short, chief of staff of Vice President Pence, talking about apprehensions at the U.S. southern border.
It's more about actually seeing what are the actions taken that will drop those numbers. 144,000 last month. We're on pace this year for over 1 million apprehensions on our side of the border. The apprehensions on the other side of the border have been declining. So we need to see Mexico's actions.
What sort of actions would it take for the White House to not go through with tariffs?
The Trump administration not only wants Mexico to seal off its own southern border with Guatemala, which has been the gateway through which the Central Americans have been starting their journey towards the United States, it also wants Mexico to crack down on Central Americans who are already in Mexico making their way north. And it wants to basically have Mexico provide a way station for those who are seeking asylum in the United States. In fact, the Trump administration would rather see those Central Americans seek asylum in Mexico rather than coming to the U.S. The administration has been very frustrated with the growing number of undocumented migrants who have been apprehended at our southern border each month. This week we learned that 144,000 undocumented migrants were apprehended in the month of May. There have been more than 100,000 apprehended in each of the last 3 months. That is a big source of frustration for the president, and that's the number he wants to see changed.
So the question is, could Mexico accommodate hundreds of thousands of migrants? Mexican officials and U.S. economists have all pointed out that hurting the Mexican economy through tariffs could just give people there more reason to try to move to another country, such as the United States.
Yeah, this could have the perverse ricochet effect of simply worsening Mexico's economy and actually causing more migration from Mexico. We have not seen a very large influx of migrants from Mexico, although Mexico has been a transit point for Central Americans coming to the U.S. But if Mexico's own economy takes a hit as a result of these tariffs, that could certainly change.
U.S. and Mexico are running out of time, though. The tariffs are set to be imposed on Monday. Any sense of how the talks could progress between now and then?
Well, only in the sense that we've had a couple of years to watch this president do his negotiations, and there's often a lot of brinkmanship involved. So this could certainly come right down to the wire, or even the tariffs could go into effect as a cudgel to try to get Mexico to move further.
You've been reporting, Scott, on the jobs report that came out earlier today. It is rather weak, and I wonder if Donald Trump's trade policies are having an impact on employment here.
Rather weak is an understatement. The U.S. added just 75,000 jobs last month. That's less than half of what analysts had been forecasting, and it's about half of what has been the average over the last 3 months. Certainly, some observers have pointed to trade tensions as a possible factor to the extent that it has contributed to uncertainty among employers. And when we're talking about trade tensions here, we're talking about China. Obviously, the threat of tariffs on Mexican imports has come up just since this job survey was done back in the middle of May. But the China tariffs were already in place at that point. So certainly trade could be a part of it. I should say I spoke earlier today with Kevin Hassett, the White House economist. He downplayed the significance of the May jobs numbers, suggested this could be a temporary blip. Let's take a listen.
There's a big weather story in this number, and I think that that's something that a lot of people have missed. But the flooding of the Mississippi is a really, really serious thing, that it closed I-29. A lot of the ports were closed. And our estimate is that it took about 40,000 off this number. And that's something that we would expect to bounce back as soon as the floods, it got willing receipt.
Lisa, I happened to be in St. Louis this past week and witnessed some of that high water of the Mississippi and Missouri rivers, and certainly that has had an impact on transportation. It may have affected warehousing employment. But no question, this was a big downshift in what had been a pretty robust job growth. And it's going to be another factor that the Federal Reserve will take into account when the Fed's interest rate setting committee meets in less than 2 weeks. They're going to be under some pressure to cut interest rates to try to prolong the economic expansion, maybe not in their June meeting, but sooner rather than later. And investors are sort of banking on a interest rate cut in the not-too-distant future. That's one of the reasons we're seeing the big surge on Wall Street today.
NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley. Thank you, Scott.
Great to be with you, Lisa.
Well, it's been more than 30 years since Yucca Mountain in Nevada was picked as the nation's nuclear waste site. The state of Nevada has been fighting the project ever since, and under the Obama administration, the plan was scrapped. But fast forward to the Trump White House, and the long-running debate about storing nuclear waste in Yucca Mountain is back on the table. Noah Glick from member station KUNR reports.
Pahrump, Nevada is one of the closest towns to Yucca Mountain, which sits in Nye County, one of the poorest areas in Nevada.
Good morning. Hey. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
Marilyn Davis moved here 18 years ago.
There's a lot of history. There's a lot of good things that happened here.
Like many people in this small town of 36,000, Davis supports opening the waste site.
It will never have houses. There will never be people living there. Why not use it and do something useful with the property?
Davis runs the town's museum and historical society, and the history of Yucca Mountain is the central exhibit.
And this is just the overall picture of what's actually Yucca Mountain.
If you're wondering, Yucca Mountain is an actual mountain. The idea is that holes and tunnels would be drilled into it to hold high-level spent nuclear fuel sent from sites around the country. But there's no waste in Yucca Mountain today. The repository was defunded under the Obama administration. Down the road from the museum, Megan Thomas manages a local hardware store. She wants to see the waste site come, too.
Anything that would help our economy would be great. This town needs some fresh blood and some new businesses.
Thomas grew up in Pahrump and was a teenager when the project was defunded. That means much of the roughly 90,000 metric tons of the nation's nuclear waste continues to be stored where it's produced, on-site in large pools at nuclear power plants. But the Trump administration says it makes sense to have a central repository. And there's renewed congressional interest in that idea. The U.S. House Appropriations Committee recently debated the issue. Idaho Republican Mike Simpson wants to get the project up and running.
It is time to stop the needless delays in this process. 48 out of 53 of us on this committee have nuclear waste in our states.
But not everyone in Nevada wants that waste. The Western Shoshone Nation says the land is sacred and should not be poisoned. And Nevada Democratic Senator Jackie Rosen has several concerns.
It's hard to imagine that shipping over 5,000 truck casks of high-level nuclear waste over a span of 50 years won't result in at least one radiological release.
Plus, she says Yucca Mountain is next to the nation's largest Air Force live munitions testing area.
So does it really make sense to transport and store our nation's nuclear waste right next to a military bombing range?
There's also an elephant in the room, trust, or lack of it. Abby Johnson works with neighboring Eureka County.
With above and underground nuclear weapons testing, people in Nevada had already experienced being lied to by the federal government and had had their families poisoned by fallout from the atomic bombs.
Some Nevadans are willing to trust the government again. Daryl Lacey is the director of the Yucca Mountain Project in Nye County. He says the site offers a chance to get federal dollars for key services.
Transportation issues are something we talk a lot about, improved highways. But let the federal government pay for it as part of the Yucca Mountain Project.
As for transporting spent nuclear fuel, that happens safely all the time, he says. He's more worried about the current patchwork of nuclear waste storage across the nation.
There's 15 or so shut down nuclear power plants today that have waste sitting on concrete pads behind a chain link fence with a couple of rent-a-cops.
We've been dealt a hand.
That's Nye County Commissioner Leo Blundo.
And now you have to make the best out of it. You got to turn lemons into lemonade.
Blundo says Nevada could adopt a similar idea to Alaska's Permanent Fund, which pays Alaska residents regular dividends from oil revenues. For Nevadans, it would be nuclear waste dividends. Overall, he calls the project an opportunity.
We could have post-secondary education, UNLV, School of Nuclear Engineering, Nuclear Physics, and Nuclear Reprocessing, okay? So we could take it all a step further. I want to be reprocessing this material as fast as it's coming in, reprocessing and getting it out of Nevada.
In a tight vote, the U.S. House Appropriations Committee decided against refunding the Yucca Mountain Project. But the Senate is still considering it, and both sides say the fight isn't over yet. For Here and Now, I'm Noah Glick.
Well, Lisa, another story we're following. NASA says it is going to open up the International Space Station to tourism as early as 2020, and people will be able to go up there for 30 days. And here's the cost. $35,000 a night to stay there, a very expensive hotel, but $50 million at least to get there.
You must have a pretty good view for that.
And hopefully you get a lot of points if you do that.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat. Ever wish feeling too hot or too cold were optional? As summer heats up outside, just press for a thermal wave designed to provide cooling relief. Over-air-conditioned inside? Leave that sweater in the car and rely on Emberwave instead. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave. Control your comfort.
The Tony Awards are on Sunday, and the musical Hadestown, which opened on Broadway in April, has been nominated for 14 awards, including Best Musical. It's a retelling of the Greek myth of Orpheus and Eurydice.
Once upon a time there was a railroad line. Don't ask where, brother, don't ask where.
Orpheus is a young dreamer and songwriter, and Eurydice is his muse, who captures the attention of Hades, who brings her into the underworld. Orpheus follows Eurydice down to rescue her. The book, lyrics, and music of Hadestown are by singer-songwriter Aeneas Mitchell. It's directed by Rachel Chavkin. Both have been nominated for Tonys. I saw it last year in London before the cast picked up and headed for New York, and I sat down with three cast members, Patrick Page, who plays Hades, Eva Noblezada, who plays Eurydice, and Reeve Carney, who plays Orpheus. I began by asking what it's like to take an old tale and make it new with Aeneas Mitchell's music.
It was a world of gods and men.
I think the great thing about Greek tragedies is they exist to teach us about ourselves. And so our show kind of places it in an undetermined time within sort of a club setting, so it feels like it does have a timeless element, but in a different way than the Greek myths.
It feels new because of the songs, but you're right. It's undetermined, maybe a depression, maybe even earlier than that.
Yeah, and the music for me was the thing that attracted me to the project to begin with. It was unlike anything I'd heard on Broadway before. Mm. More like things I listened to at home, mm-hmm. like Leonard Cohen, Tom Waits, Jeff Buckley, Joni Mitchell. Mm-hmm. It had a sound that just hooked me in, and songs that I wanted to sing and songs that I wanted to listen to. I tell everybody that my dirty little secret about the show is that although I've now been involved with this show over a period of 3 years and have performed it many times and rehearsed it many, 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 many mm-hmm. times, I will still, when I go to the gym, put on a song from the show to work out because I like the music that much.
Eva, what about you? What attracted you to this show?
I think the fact that the music is very expressive, so no matter who's listening to it and what their musical background may have been when they were growing up or what influences them most, the music is kind of a free-for-all. You take what you get and you let it wash over you, and it's such an experience for the singers and performers as well. It sounds different to me every night, so it's hugely fresh every single night.
Now, I was going to wait to ask you about this, Patrick, but since people have just heard your voice, we have to talk about how low it goes in this show. I mean, it's just when you speak, it's this deep voice unlike any other. But in the show, you have to sing very, very low.
Hey, little songbird, give me a song. I'm a busy man and I can't stay long.
Anais wrote this crazy role, you know, which is the king of the underworld. And, you know, it is truly, we call it sometimes a folk opera, and I'm never sure exactly what that means. But in terms of the way it stretches the singers' voices, you know, I don't have to do a whole lot to embody the king of the underworld, because Anais has already done that with where she's written the role.
Yeah.
So he sings in a way that you don't normally hear someone sing on stage, and that tells you right off the bat, oh, he's supernatural, he's not a human being. And in a way, she's done the same thing with Orpheus. Reeve has to sing these
very high,
ridiculously high notes.
It's actually really exciting for me to be involved in a theatrical project that allows you to use those parts of your range, because it is quite unusual on both the low end and the high end for Patrick and I. But it's great, because I grew up listening to a lot of female singers, and Bobby McFerrin was a huge influence on me. And so for me, it's awesome to have a chance to mess with that on stage in a theatrical setting.
Well, the other thing is it really brings forward the idea that your character with those high notes is sort of the idealist, and you, Patrick, are kind of the realist. You're down on the ground, underground,
I guess. That old opera tradition of the bass being the heavy and the tenor being the hero, you know, and it's and yet completely modern in this context.
That word modern, Eva, how do you take a character like yours, which is sort of scrappy, and make it modern and relatable?
Is scrappy not modern?
I guess scrappy would be modern.
Well, in the original myth, Eurydice doesn't really have a voice. She kind of just waifs around and then goes back down underground. And I think what's incredible is that with the people, the creatives on the team, they've really allowed me to express it in a way that she is very scrappy and punky, and she's a survivor, but she also uses her instincts to make certain choices without giving too much away. And there's also a beautiful love story, and that's also, I think, as modern as you can get with portraying falling in love. Everyone can relate to that. So, yeah, it was nice to give her a voice and for her not to be victimized in this play.
Now, you're doing this show in the United States at a time when, obviously, we've been hearing a lot about building the wall. President Trump talking about building the wall. In your show, which was written before President Trump started saying that, you, Patrick, your character, has people building a wall. And there's a song about it.
How does the wall keep us free? My children, how does the wall keep us free?
Yeah, I mean, in addition to being an extraordinary poet, lyricist, and composer, it seems that Anais is a bit of a prophet.
Right.
She's taken this idea of a wall, and a wall that can never be finished, which must always be worked on, and put it into the show. But she said once, you know, that any similarity between that wall and any current wall being built or pretending to be built in the United States is purely archetypal.
Yeah.
But there's going to be a reaction in this country that is going to be probably different even than overseas, just because of the conversation that's going on right now.
It is different. But anytime you have someone who's trying to hold on to power, which is what my character is doing. He's trying at that moment to build up his own sense of himself, his own sense of power, because his relationship is threatened with his marriage. You know, political things come from personal things. Mm-hmm. So he's feeling threatened in his personal life. He goes out and holds a rally in which he gets everyone to chant about building a wall.
Crazy.
What about the politics of it, Reeve?
Well, I agree with Patrick. I think that the physical walls we tend to create as humans tend to stem from emotional walls, the walls that we build against intimacy and togetherness, unity, all those things. I mean, there's so many walls that you can build that prevent you from feeling something.
Yeah.
That's where I think it starts. And our show deals with all those themes. I mean, you know, love, fear, hope, trust, doubt,
And the world now is so complex and moving so fast and so scary that it's not surprising to me that people would want to think, oh, well, there's a solution. We'll simply build this barrier and we'll keep all of the good people inside and we'll put all of the bad people on the outside and we'll be safe. That's what Hades is appealing to. Hades is appealing to everybody's desire, in particular Eurydice's desire, to feel safe and comfortable at the expense of feeling loved, feeling creative, and feeling free. She can have one or the other. At least that's the bargain that I offer her, until Orpheus shows her that necessarily it's not like that. Mm-hmm. You can perhaps choose love and creativity and freedom, and you can still have some sense of security.
That's beautiful.
I want to just ask each of you, finally, what it is like to do this show night after night after night after night for so long.
Oh, it's great. You discover new things every day, don't you think?
Mm. Yeah, you certainly do. And, I mean, we're very lucky that with the company we get to keep, yeah, with Amber Gray, Andre DeShields, and our team, you know, Aeneas, Rachel Chavkin, who really is, you know, a genius.
Yeah.
The energy that the audience is now giving us. This is my 15th Broadway show, and I have never, ever seen any reaction like this from an audience.
What do you mean?
It's like being at a rock concert.
It is.
It's like being when I would go see Bono and Edge and U2. You know, the energy that the audience is feeding to the stage, the energy. We have 300, 400, 500 people waiting for us at the stage door when we come out.
Wow.
Because they don't want the experience to end. They want to have just a little more contact with the people that they saw on the stage. Mm-hmm. So I know something very special is happening.
That is Patrick Page. We've also been speaking with Reeve Carney and Eva Noblezada. They are all in the musical Hadestown, which is on Broadway at the Walter Kerr Theater. Thank you so much to all of you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
It's a sad tale, it's a tragedy. It's a sad song.
It's a sad song.
The U.S. economy added 75,000 jobs last month, according to a Labor Department report out today. That number is far below what was expected, and that is causing concern. The unemployment rate is still at 3.6%. That's close to a 50-year low. Claire Sebastian is a business correspondent for CNN. She joins us from New York. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Lisa.
So analysts had expected more than double the number of job gains for May. What happened?
Yeah, so it's not actually just about the May number. That's not the only reason for concern here. There were also revisions to the numbers for March and April, a collective revision down of another 75,000. So two times 75,000 causing concern here. And really, the reason why people are so worried is up until now, the jobs report was really seen as a bit of a bright spot, the jobs market generally, in an economy that's showing some signs of fraying. So it's starting to look like either the general uncertainty related to slowing growth globally, to trade tensions, either that is playing in, or really it's the effect of a skills gap, companies just not able to find the right people to fill the jobs they have, or perhaps a combination of the two.
You mentioned trade. Talk about the tariff factor, because President Trump is saying this afternoon he is preparing to impose tariffs on Mexico on Monday unless there's some kind of an agreement between the two countries between now and then. The U.S. is already in a trade war with China. Is there a link between the disappointing job creation numbers and the fears over trade?
So it's hard to quantify exactly how much of this is related to trade, but economists feel generally that this helped create a sense of kind of malaise that could have led companies to hold back on hiring. Really, the first thing you get in terms of the impact of this trade war is a drop in confidence and people putting plans on hold. One economist said to me this week that one of the biggest risks to the U.S. economy is that we talk ourselves into a recession, that even before you see a real pressure on costs from tariffs and things like that, a real concrete impact, that the drop in confidence is what's really corrosive. So it does seem, certainly according to economists that I've been speaking to, that is what's helped the drop over the past few months.
And what bearing this will have on the Federal Reserve, because during the recession, the Fed cut interest rates to near zero. In 2015, the Fed began raising rates again in the strong economy, and now apparently they're debating potentially cutting rates. What is it weighing in that calculation?
Yeah, so that's why the markets are actually up today, because they are now factoring in a greater likelihood of the Fed cutting rates. You know, it's basically based on the data. The Fed will always say they're data dependent. So this weak jobs report is another data point that the Fed is going to factor in when it decides what to do next. It's just this week that Jerome Powell, the Federal Reserve chair, gave what markets interpreted to be the clearest signal yet that he may be willing to cut rates. That would be a sharp turnaround. This time last year, the Fed was getting ready to raise rates. It did so four times over the past year. It was forecasting more rate rises in 2019. Now, potentially looking at cutting. But the reason is that they're looking at the data, they're looking at the markets, they're not seeing inflation tick up. And now unemployment, which is the other side of their mandate, is looking shaky too. So really, it does kind of compound into the potential for them to cut rates, perhaps not at the next meeting if you talk to economists, but perhaps in the months ahead if this continues.
Very briefly, the strong and weak points in the economy or what?
So manufacturing has been a bit weaker. That's something that people are watching. That's also trade sensitive. That is crucial. Things like factory output have also been showing weakness. And there are market signals, too. The yield curve has been inverting, meaning investors see short-term bonds as riskier than long-term. But mixed signals, consumer sentiment is still at a very strong position.
Claire Sebastian, business correspondent for CNN. Nice to talk to you, Claire.
Thank you, Lisa.
Democratic presidential hopefuls have until next Wednesday to qualify for the first presidential debate later this month. Candidates have to either poll at 1% in three approved polls or get donations from 65,000 people across 20 different states. And those requirements are drawing criticism, particularly from the candidates who have not made it. Joining us to look at all this is Michael Shearer, national political reporter for The Washington Post. Hi, Michael.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And I want to start with these qualifications. Candidates, as we said, have to poll at 1%. And yesterday, the party announced that some polls would be excluded, which is not going over well with some candidates. Tell us what's going on there.
Yeah. So when they announced the rules, they basically, and this was in February, they said you have to get at least 1% in three polls from a list of, I think, 18 news organizations between the beginning of the year and January 12th, next week. They did not make any distinction about what kind of polls. Now, one of the polls, the Washington Post ABC poll, asked an open-ended question. So instead of listing off multiple choice, here's 20 names, who do you support for president? They just asked people, who do you support for president? Now, the DNC had said privately earlier this year and then publicly for the first time yesterday that they don't want to take open-ended polls, which cuts out two of the news organizations they originally listed and effectively changes the rules that they announced in February. And that's going to affect really one candidate right now, Montana Governor Steve Bullock, whose third qualifying poll for the debates was a January ABC Washington Post poll, who now doesn't have enough to qualify.
Okay, so there are 20 debate spots when you look at these debates over two nights, but there are 24 Democratic candidates. Who so far has qualified and who hasn't?
Well, the only four who have not yet met the polling threshold, which is the easier one to meet at this point, are Seth Moulton, the congressman from Massachusetts, Wayne Messam, a mayor from Florida, and Bullock. And Mike Gravel is the other one. He's listed sometimes in the list of 24. Some people say 23 candidates rank. Some people say 24. He hasn't really done any events, or he doesn't have much of a campaign organization, but he also is not yet qualified in the polls. 13 people have qualified both by polling and by meeting the 65,000 threshold. That number could go up by next week because a number of people are still trying to meet that deadline. If Bullock or Messam or Moulton are able to or Gravel are able to qualify by polling before next week, then there'll be a runoff to figure out who.
A runoff? How does that work?
Yeah. It's a little complicated, but in this case, it'll basically be the person with the highest polling. The problem is all these people are polling at 1%, so how they actually figure that out will be complicated, and they may actually have to bring in the number of donors to do a sort of tie break there. But if Bullock gets a third poll, for instance, before next week, then there'll be 21 people who have qualified and only 20 will be able to appear on stage.
You haven't said the word superdelegate yet. I assume they don't get involved if there's like a tiebreaker to the tiebreaker.
Yeah, no. Although it is true that Democrats tend to have incredibly complicated rules in the name of fairness, and that is proving itself once again.
And just more on the logistics here, how will it work once the debate stages are set? How do they decide who gets to go on which night?
Well, so originally they said it would be basically a random drawing. They didn't want to have a big table and a little table like Republicans did in the last cycle. But they've since modified that to be somewhat more complicated in the name of fairness. They will now have two drawings. One drawing will be people who are polling for people who are polling higher, and it will divide them between the two nights. And then they'll have a second drawing for people who are polling lower to divide them between the two nights. And the idea is that they didn't want to randomly put all of the top tier candidates on one stage and bottom tier candidates on the other stage. So they're sort of putting in some insurance. What that means practically is that, you know, the names that most Americans know and are interested in right now, the ones who've polled, you know, above 5%, may not appear on the same stage, or one or two of them may be cut out. They won't be able to appear on a stage with the two people who are polling the best right now, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. And so there's some suspense in how this will all sort out.
Okay. Well, you mentioned the Republican primary last time around. So I want to listen back to what that was like when there was a big debate stage filled with a lot of candidates. August 2015, the first Republican primary presidential debate, it was also divided into two separate sessions. And here's a moment where you got 10 candidates on the stage, and the Fox News moderator Brett Baer threw the first question out to everyone, and he asked candidates to raise their hands, and only one person did. You can probably guess who that was. Let's listen.
Is there anyone on stage, and can I see hands, who is unwilling tonight to pledge your support to the eventual nominee of the Republican Party and pledge to not run an independent campaign against that person? Again, we're looking for you to raise your hand now. Raise your hand now if you won't make that pledge tonight. Mr. Trump. So, Mr. Trump, to be clear, you're standing on a Republican primary debate.
I fully understand.
Okay, so there he is drawing boos minutes after that debate started. Now, I wonder, looking back at that and knowing that he's now the president of the United States, how important is it in a big field on a stage to get attention, even if it's negative attention, in a debate like this?
Well, that was President Trump's real innovation in the 2016 race, and it clearly has benefited him not just in the election, but in the White House. He continues to sort of crave and do what he can to get attention every day. It's not clear, though, I think that that would work with a Democratic electorate in quite the same way. The parties tend to think differently and look for different things in their candidates this early in the process. The driving question among Democrats right now, more than issues, more than personality, more than experience, is really who can beat Trump. There's a real desire among Democrats to figure out who can beat Trump. And I expect that these first two debates will be debated along those lines, and there'll be different ways that different candidates have of making their case. And some of them will be showing weakness in the people at the front of the line right now, especially Joe Biden. And some of it will just be trying to distinguish yourself in some way as someone who could stand there with the president, a year from now.
I bet, though, that there will be at least one question in the debate, which is a raise your hand question, because it is an easy way to see if anybody stands out in the crowd. There will also be people, of course, who don't get a lot of time in these debates. I want to listen to one more clip. This is from the first Democratic presidential primary debate in October 2015 on CNN, which had five candidates: Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Martin O'Malley, Lincoln Chafee, and Jim Webb. And here's a moment when CNN's Anderson Cooper interrupted O'Malley, and you can hear Jim Webb try to edge his way in.
Governor O'Malley, just for the record, on the campaign trail, you've been saying that Secretary Clinton is always quick for the military invention. Senator Secretary Clinton, you can respond.
Well, first
Anderson,
of all,
can I get into this discussion at some point?
Yes, you'll be coming in next, but she was directly quoted.
Thank you. So. I've been standing over here for about 10 minutes trying. Okay. It's just it's gone back and
Secretary,
forth over there.
Well, I am in the middle here, and lots of things coming from all directions.
I feel like there's going to be at least one person like poor Jim Webb in these debates.
There will, and that was Jim Webb's last debate of that cycle as well. It didn't end well for him. I think you're going to have, you know, at minimum 10 people on each stage, limited answers. Traditionally, there's a chance to respond if you're attacked, and what that means in practice is that the bigger names are attacked more often and therefore get more time to talk. I think a lot of the debate preparation over the next few weeks is going to be about, if you only have 3 minutes to introduce yourself here, what is the message you want to get across, and how do you want to deliver it? And each of those candidates will be practicing and refining and rehearsing those answers. And it may also be that the thing that that we remember from these debates is the thing that no one prepared for, mm-hmm. Which we can't really predict and which will be spontaneous. And that's really what the debates provide, a chance to sort of catch candidates out, see how they think on their feet and either perform or don't perform, which arguably is the thing that distinguished Trump in the Republican primary last time.
Well, I have to think that the candidate at the top of the polls right now, Joe Biden, is in a way the one that has the most to lose here, because all these other people, many of whom people in the country haven't seen much of, are finally going to get to see some of them, and maybe they will change their mind even if they like Joe Biden right now.
That's very possible. It's also possible he performs very well,
right,
and that his rivals don't. It's also possible he ends up picking a lucky draw and finds himself on stage, which, with a bunch of people who have a real struggle, you know, proving that they're likely to be elected. This is the first of 12 debate cycles that the DNC has planned. So we have a long road ahead of us, and whoever the nominee is going to be is going to have to sit through a lot of these and perform in a lot of these.
Michael Shearer, national political reporter at the Washington Post. Thanks.
Thank you.
We're going to get an update now on the new crisis in one of Africa's largest countries, Sudan. Opposition leaders are demanding that a paramilitary unit they say carried out a violent crackdown earlier this week be dismantled. More than 100 people were killed in the event. The opposition also wants the military to hand over power to civilians. The BBC's Catherine Biaro-Hunga is in Khartoum. And Catherine, give us the background first. What laid the groundwork for the violence that we're seeing in Sudan now?
So what we've had in Sudan since December is a period of mass protests across the country, and the main demand from the people here had been the removal of the former president, Omar al-Bashir. He'd been in power for over 3 decades. There were a series of mass protests from December till April, when there was a mass sit-in in the capital here. At that point, the army and other security forces joined with the protesters and they staged a coup against Bashir. After he was removed from office, the demonstrators went on to demand that the military, the security forces, should hand power over to a civilian transitional authority. However, the military was opposed to this. They insisted that they should be the ones who had overall control. What we saw earlier this week on Monday is the military security forces move in and break up this mass protest that had thousands of people in the capital. What we understand from Doctors Aligned to the Opposition is that at least 100 people were killed in this crackdown, and there have been more killings throughout the week. So this is the stage, this is where we stand, and there is a real sense of fear and shock in Sudan at the moment.
Well, so the army had joined the protesters in their common interest in ousting Omar al-Bashir, who had been wanted for crimes against humanity. So once he was out of the picture, the army decided that it wanted to hold on to power for how long? Does the army have any intent at all to transition to democracy, which is what the protesters want?
What the army said when they took over is that they would like to hold elections within a year, within a few months. The protesters were opposed to this. They felt that this rush from the military was an attempt for the military to usurp power once again. Many of these generals were the generals that kept the former president in power. Most of the politicians in office were the politicians that kept the former regime in power. So they wanted time to break down these structures, and they felt that in rushing towards elections, this was not going to happen.
So the African Union suspended Sudan yesterday from membership because of this crisis. What's the significance of that?
Usually when a coup takes place, the African Union immediately suspends the country in question. This time they said, okay, you're saying the right things, you're talking about democracy, let's give you time to hand over to a civilian authority. Now, the massacre that happened here in Khartoum on Monday shook the African Union officials. They felt they needed to act at that particular moment because not only were the military dragging their feet in handing over to civilians, they were also now accused of grave crimes. So the African Union suspended Sudan and then also asked for an investigation into these killings. So it's just the nature of the crackdown and the worries about the severity of the abuses happening in Khartoum at the moment.
Catherine, when a lot of Americans hear about Sudan, they think of the Darfur region and the horrific violence that happened in 2003. Are there fears that there might be even more widespread violence in the country now because of this unrest caused apparently by the military?
Right now at this moment, much of the power is in the hands of the Rapid Support Forces militia group. This is a militia group that was born out of the Janjaweed militia that carried out so many of the crimes in Darfur. And right now in Khartoum, when people look at the site of the crackdown here against protesters, you will find burnt out tents, you will find scorch marks, people who have been shot in the head, and there are also reports of women being raped. For lots of people now, this reminds them of the crimes committed in Darfur by the Janjaweed, now in the capital by the Rapid Support Forces, who have their origins in the Janjaweed. The opposition want this group to be disbanded, but right now they have so much control of the security structures in the capital and outside in other parts of the country that many people wonder whether it will be possible to really disband this group right now.
That's the BBC's Catherine Biar-Hungar, who's speaking to us from Khartoum, Sudan, where the military is accused of killing more than 100 pro-democracy protesters. Catherine, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.